Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all ready to ride? Around the block now, everyday scene, dope fiends and the cops round. At any traffic stop, we could be shot down, and in the courts it's just us. Justice is not found.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to Injust Us, the show that shares stories of injustice and allows listeners to ask questions and seek advice. Each week, we feature guests who are making a difference in the Black community and or changing the criminal justice system. My name is Melinda Robertson, and I am your host and member of the WPGR All-Female Radio Network. I am the founder of Black Mothers for Justice Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization created to be a support system for mothers of incarcerated children. I will be hosting a virtual launch release of Mother's Guide. I wrote this out of necessity, not a wealth of resources that will help mothers navigate their way to a conflict process if a child is arrested. Just need a book with me. Tonight's featured guest, been on the front line for over 25 years. Please join me in welcoming Brother Al Malik Farrakhan to the show. Hey, my brother, how are you today?
Hey, sis. I barely can hear you, though, Melinda. Keep breaking in, breaking up. Hello?
Hello? You hear me now? Is this better? Is this better?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. But I haven't heard anything basically you have said, you know?
Oh, I'm so sorry. It must be my plugs. Okay. Good evening. Tonight's featured guest, Brother Al Malik Farrakhan, is the CEO and Executive Director of Ceasefire, Don't Smoke the Brothers and Sisters Incorporated, a nonprofit grassroots 501c3 organization created in response to the violence and crimes that continue to plague the Black community nationwide. He has been on the front line for over 25 years, going up against the police, gang leaders, ex-offenders, etc., to save our young people. Please join me in Brother Al Malik Farrakhan to the show. My brother, how are you?
I hear peace, and then I don't. But I heard you say how I'm doing. I'm doing great. Praises be to Allah. And thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's a blessing to have you on the show. It's so good to have you, especially a man like you. You have been making such a difference in the community with Ceasefire. I just commend you. So let's get into it. Hopefully we can keep our connection going well. I don't know what it is, but we're going to rebuke that, and we're just going to go move full ahead. So you joined the Nation of Islam under the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad at what age?
18.
Wow. What inspired you to join so young?
Well, my brother was going to the mosque, Randolph X. Green, but I was down on the host road. and I was standing among some white hookers. And I don't mess with white women, right? Brothers drove up in the pink Cadillac and said, "Brother, buy one of these papers." And I was kind of intoxicated, and some of the spit came out my mouth, and it went on the brother, and we got into a rumble. And, man, I was so intoxicated that they threw me in the car and took me down to the mosque. When I got down to the mosque, it was brothers that knew me, right, before they went into the mosque. And they told the captain and them, said, "Man, that's a great soldier right there." So they put me in the front in the mosque, and I dozed off the street. But I heard Dr. Lana Shabazz say, "The snake." And I jumped up, man. And them brothers, they moved at me like they was going to move on me, but they didn't. And then they took me after the service, took me downstairs and fed me good and the whole shot. But the service was so powerful, even though I was kind of out, I could still hear it. And that's what inspired me to go.
Wow, wow. That's amazing. So you grew up in D.C. and was part of the LaJoy Park and 1-4 gang. What made you join the gang?
But say it again.
I'm sorry.
You know, you're breaking up. I hear just only a little bit of it.
I'm sorry. So in D.C. and was part of, were you the founder of the D.C. Park 1-4 gang, or were you the
participant? No. I was the founder of the 1-4, right?
Okay.
And I was a member of the Detro Park and also a member of the Decatur Street Gang.
Okay. So what makes a young brother want to join a gang?
Well, a lot of times love, protection. You know, you don't get that attention that you might need. You find camaraderie and et cetera. You find ride or die partners, things of that nature, you know? So a lot of times you're not getting at home, they cause you to drift off into a gang, or it could be for protection. You know, in my case, I was told that I wouldn't be nothing, I ain't going to be nothing, and, you know, I'd run away from home and things of that nature and wind up staying at different brothers' houses or women's houses. And, you know, I wind up doing that. But when I started the 14th Street Gang, we had moved from downtown to uptown in 54. And we moved uptown. It was nothing but white folks up here. And it was only three black families up here. And they would call us the N-word and throw bricks and everything else at us. So every time a black family would come up and they had a boy, and I would recruit them to fight them crackers, man.
What year was that? What year are we talking about? Early 70s?
No, that was before the 70s, sweetie. That was in the 60s.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. Oh, okay. So what's the difference?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that was at a very young age. I was experiencing racism right here in Chocolate City.
Okay. So what's the difference between the gangs of your day and the gangs of today?
Well, you know, back then it was more discipline, and there was codes that we had. Codes do not apply today. You know, you normally would have one leader, right? And he would call the shots. Today, you have multitudes of leaders. In one particular area, that's supposed to be a gang, and they got no cut cards, and that's because they wasn't taught. I would like, before I go any further, I would like to apologize to my people, and especially the young folks, because in the 60s we're the ones that started the gunplay, when normally most gangs would go hand to hand and you know, bats and things of that nature, and the gunplay right uptown up here. So I'd like to apologize for putting them in the position that they in today.
Wow. Wow, that's So you said you guys started the gunplay. Okay.
Yes, yes, ma'am. Uptown, yes, we did.
Wow. So you were in and out of prison during the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, during time on the East End. Oh, really? Okay, no?
No, ma'am. You know, I didn't go to prison that much, all right?
Okay.
I was in prison in the 60s, the 70s, and then the 80s, right?
Okay.
And then came home in the 90s, right? But I escaped from prison, right? They had locked me up on a charge that wasn't mine. They gave me 5 to 20, 3 to 10, an indeterminate life sentence. I had been found not guilty on 5 other charges prior to that. I have a brother by the name of LeVance Green Bay and Randolph Green, and I consider both of them a revolutionary. And it was the same time that George and Jonathan Jackson, actually Jonathan Jackson, was making the move trying to free his brother George Jackson. Then my brother, which is LeVance Green Bay, who's been locked up 50 years, tried to free my brother Randolph, who was doing a 25-year sentence and wound up killing a United States Marshal. So behind the fact of that, they was on my back like white on rice. So when they locked me up, it was not for what I had done, but it was about the situation that had took place.
Okay. So while you were in prison in L.A., you were severely beaten in your jail cell after per gang member, which left you paralyzed and confined to a wheelchair. Okay. Was that the defining moment that made you give up gang banging?
No. I had been stopped the gang, right? Even though I still had some of that in me. See, back in the 60s, most of the gangs had wound up going in the SNCC Corps, the Nation of Islam, Black Panthers, and et cetera. You feel me? But I still had some gang mentality. Now, when I was out in L.A. jail, I had been to several other cities trying to prove my innocence, right? And and I got caught up out there in L.A. and got locked up. But I was the minister. Now, first, I didn't go to jail and become a Muslim. I got my ex while I was in the street. Then I wound up going to jail when they set me up, right? And when I got in L.A., you know, I don't think we have enough time to talk about that L.A. County jail system, but it is a recruiting station. It's a recruiting station for the Aryan Brotherhood, the Ku Klux Klan, the Texas Syndicate, right, which has been proven. We proved that in court when we went to trial, and we won. We were one of the only people that ever beat the L.A. and Los Angeles sheriff in trial, and it came out that was a group station. While I was in there, before they beat me down, they burned a cross in front of my cell. I'll send you the newspaper article so you can read about it. And they raped the black sheriff, females, inside the jail. They would wear their Ku Klux Klan uniform in there. And the black officers were scared to death, man, to even attempt to correct that wrong, you know? So, it was a brother named, they called him Wild Bill, but his name was Bill Russian. And at the time, I didn't know him the first time I seen him when they beat him. He was a big young brother, and he was a blood. And I had no clue, right? And then maybe about 7 to 8 months later, they put us on the same tier. And I got to teaching them Islam. But I told him that they was going to come back and beat him again because he didn't fight back the first time. So when he came back, it was June 3rd, 1986, 6:30 in the morning, and they beat him half to death. And a Mexican mafia by the name of Flaco woke me up and said, man, they beat your partner. I told him, open the gate. He got the gate open. I went out there and helped him. And I got paralyzed. I got, you know, I got whooped worse than everybody else, you know? And, you know, it was also behind the fact that I was a Muslim. You know, and it was the time that Minister Farrakhan was going over to Libya. And they was attempting to kill Minister Farrakhan and Gaddafi. And they had dropped the bomb over there, but Minister Farrakhan had left and they killed Gaddafi's daughter.
Wow. Listeners, please press number one to join this conversation and speak with the iconic Al-Malik Farrakhan. So, brother, how long were you in a wheelchair? And when you were confined to that wheelchair, did you ever doubt that you were again?
While I was out in L.A. County, I ran into the most astonishing men that I've ever met, and they was of every nationality. Some of them didn't have no eyes, didn't have no arms, didn't have no legs. The first 30 days that I could recognize anything, I felt, man, hopeless, like it was all over with. I couldn't get an erection and none of that. And they threw me out my bed, man, and they start rubbing and keeping rubbing my legs and things and keeping my muscle tones up for me, man, when the police, because they tortured me on 10 different occasions. I ain't just get beat once and become paralyzed. That went 10 different times, putting the electric shock on my privates and all that kind of stuff, shoot me up with all kind of psychedelic drugs and things of that nature, and, you know, try to make it look as though I tried to kill self, right? But it wasn't like that. So these men, they have over in the county jail what they call 60-40. And that's where it's like a medical part, right? And I met these men in there, man, and I seen that even though they had one eye, one leg, one arm, or whatever, they wanted to continue to live. And it gave me inspiration. You know what I'm saying? And I carried it from that point. I didn't feel sorry for myself no more. The reality of it, I never thought I'd walk again because seven doctors said I wouldn't. But I always hoped that I would. And I said, irregardless, whatever happens, I'm going to do whatever I did when I was standing on my two legs. I'm going to do it from the wheelchair. That's how I got to dance with you, from the wheelchair.
Yes. And I believe we have a caller on the line. Caller, are you there? Would you like to speak with me, Brother Al-Malik? Caller, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air. Yes.
Okay. This is Brother Moses from Washington, D.C. And
hey, Brother Moses.
How you doing? Walaikum salam, Brother, Brother Malik. I want to speak about Brother Malik's organization called Ceasefire, Don't Smoke the Sisters and Brothers. And this is an organization that is in the community. And the organization has, I'm a volunteer with Ceasefire. And we've been doing a lot of community work. We feed the people. We feed hungry people. We got a clothing program. We got clothes for males and females. Brother Al-Malik has a program for 12th graders in high school so that they can come and volunteer with the organization and get some credits in their 12th grade when they go on to graduate from high school. Right, community
yes.
service. And,
yes.
He's helped a lot of kids and a lot of families, especially down there at Roosevelt High School and all throughout the city. And also, Brother Al Malik, a lot of people don't know it, but he has went out in the street on the front lines and brought people together who have been beefing and quashed a lot of beef and a lot of disputes because a lot of people wanted to resolve their disputes with guns and violence. And Brother Malik has mediated a lot of meetings. In the city and due to those meetings and the mediations have prevented a lot of murders. And
that's a blessing.
So listen,
Brother Moses, do you have a particular question that you want to ask Brother Malik real quick?
Do I have anything I want to ask
Brother
Malik?
Do you have a particular question that you want to ask him, or you just wanted to share the comment that what he's doing in the community and the difference that he's making?
Well, to Brother Malik and to you, I want to say, may Allah have peace and blessings upon you every day. Y'all keep your prayers in. I know Brother Malik is praying 5 or 10
Absolutely.
Times a day. And Brother Malik, you keep up the good work. You keep up the good work, what you're doing, because I don't know nobody who can fill Brother Malik's shoes and take his place with what he's doing. I mean, he is an asset to the community. He's a gentleman's gentleman, and he's a five-star, five-diamond man. And,
thank you so much, Brother Moses, for sharing that with us. And continue to stay on the line and listen to this this icon that we have on the line, okay? Thank you. Brother Malik, despite your paralysis, you were committed to being a part of the solution. And in 95, that's when you founded Ceasefire, Don't Smoke the Brothers, and the Brothers, Inc. Where did that originate from?
Well, actually, it started before that. It started while I was in the penitentiary. All right? And,
okay.
As far as how the name got, Elijah Kareem, I had sent him different letters and things out the street about some of the things that was going on in there. And we had different code words that we would use. And one of the code words was lock and load, right? And if I said ceasefire, he knew that I was cool. But if I said lock and load, then he knew something was up, and he needed to make all kind of phone calls. But it was Minister Louis Farrakhan that prompted me to do what I'm doing. In 1989, and I'm paralyzed, reading to me. Like I said, I was the minister, one of the ministers there, right, on the unit that I was on. And he had said that there was a contract on black youth by the government, and that we need to save our babies and stop the black-on-black killing, all right? So as they transported me from place to place, and I was running the different gangs and et cetera, and gang members, I would spread that word, right? And I sent it out to Brother Elijah Kareem, and when I came home, he had the ceasefire T-shirts made with ceasefire, don't smoke the brothers and sisters on them. But when I hit the street, which was 93, is when I started recruiting. I had Anthony Muhammad. He's the ANC over there, Ward 8, and he's in the Nation of Islam. He was one of the ministers over the jail. He was the only minister for the nation over the jail, though. And I told him that what my plans was, and I asked him to pick me up when I got released and take me to every hot spot in the city where the killings was taking place. And that's what he did. And when I got to find my way around and how to use public transportation, I would go on my own. I even went over to Bird Farms, and, man, brother smacked the shit out of me, man. Excuse my language.
Really? Why you in the wheelchair subline?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm telling you, right? I had one stick of Uzi in my mouth, and a brother pulled a brother pulled a gat and stuck it to his temple. And said, if you pull the trigger on that man and you're my man, I got to down you. I was in the jail with this brother. And this is the only hope that we got. This brother goes hard from the wheelchair about us. And that was the only thing I believed that stopped that brother besides Allah from blowing my head off. But when the brother smacked me out the wheelchair, he was funny.
He was talking about he was
going to stump me. I have never been a punk, right? I have never been a weak man. You feel me? In that wheelchair or not in that wheelchair. And he stood over talking to me, kept talking about what he was going to do. And I wrapped around him like an octopus. And I pulled him down to the ground with me and grabbed him by his Adam's apple. You feel me? Until they got me off him, and he became one of my strongest members over there in Southeast.
Wow, look at Allah. Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. So C5 started with a group of about 50 gang members that all had the desire to stop the black-on-black killing. You sought the help of the late, great Mayor for Life, Marion Barry Jr., who embraced the idea and stood with you. How were you able to connect with him, and why do you...
As we know him affectionately, Marion Barry, right? We go all the way back to the 60s. I never was in Pride, but I used to be around Pride. So I had a first-hand knowledge about who this man was and the love that he had for his people. And he had, we, ex-prisoners, I don't use the term returning citizen, all right? A citizen is one who enjoys all equal rights and opportunities of the land, of the law, of the government that we live under. And those of us that come out of prison, we don't enjoy that. So I call myself an ex-prisoner, right? Because I feel that I was a prisoner. He seen me bring young ex-prisoners with me when we was trying to re-elect him. And if you look in the Washington Post, there's an article in there about the alumni of Vern Burr got him back in office, right? And I was bringing those young soldiers with me. And I told him, I said, man, I got a plan, you know, of how to take and turn these young brothers' lives back around. See, I never took away from them. I never wanted to do that, right? I wanted them to have that, but know who the real enemy was, how to go and fight for their rights, right? I mean, I done took them down to North Carolina, behind to protect Reverend Willie Wilson, when they went down there to tell Fairclough to keep his hands off Washington, D.C., and Murray particularly, Harry Thomas House. I done took him and showed him the real enemy. You know, but first, the only way I could do that, I had to teach them who they were. I had to teach them their culture. But most of all, not through talking. See, anybody can talk. But I led by it, you dig? And, man, Allah blessed me with some tough soldiers, man. And it wasn't no easy job. You know, most of them didn't know, but their fathers and uncles and some of them knew me and said, man, that man was here all the time. You feel me? So I had to come back where I started one for it. And I sent this young brother out. He was a very strong soldier then. He's a Sunni Muslim now. He's a very strong brother. And you know, he don't like for me to call his name, but I want to give his props. because he helped me go around the city and recruit. You feel me? I mean, he brought a gang of soldiers with him. You know, the Sergeant's process off. And his name was Montel Jack, better known as Lump or the Dog Father, you know? And I can't say enough about him.
Okay. Such a blessing. Such a blessing. I believe we have another caller that would like to talk to you. Caller, are you there, caller?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. You're on the air. Hello.
Yes. As-salamu alaykum, Brother Malik. This is Zakia. Sister Zakia. And I want to ask you a question. And I always wanted to know, how long were you in the wheelchair, and how did you feel when you stood up and walked for the first time?
Well, good question, Sister Kia, assalamu alaikum, and thank you. And I used to have you out there in the street with me, putting on different events for these young folks, but I felt alhamdulillah. If you understand that, I felt tremendously great, right? I still couldn't use my private parts or nothing, but I was in the chair to 2006 is when Minister Farrakhan touched my legs over in Union Temple in front of 1,800 people. And he said a prayer in Arabic. And I said, sir, I don't know the prayer. He said, I merely asked Allah to bless Malik with the use of his legs again, because I'm going to need that wheelchair. 3.5 years later, he came back, and he was in the wheelchair, and I was standing. So it was like, that was in 2002. So add 3 more years, that was 2005, where I was actually standing with braces and things of that nature. And Sister Shakir, I feel so grateful, so humble. And I said a prayer to Allah. I said Allah, and they always say, watch what you wish for, watch what you pray for. But I asked him, I said, sir, please bless me to stand with the real soldiers one more time before you take me out of here. And showing up in 2002 in front of 1,800 people, Minister Farrakhan touched my legs, and 3 years later, I'm standing, I'm moving, I'm walking. And, it was unheard of. They said it would never happen. John Hopkins can't figure out the whole shot. But now my legs still give me problems. They still give out on me. I can be walking from out of nowhere. I just fall. You know? They just give up. But I'm standing. That's what I prayed for. That's what Minister Farrakhan prayed for. And that's what would happen.
Wow. What a testimony. What a testimony. Thank you so much, Sister. Ceasefire is committed to providing assistance and support to ex-prisoners returning home to D.C. and their families. Brother Malik, what are some of the services that you guys provided? Brother Moses kind of touched on it a little bit.
I got to go back, and I always got to give credit to where it started from, right?
Okay.
The Million Man March, right? The Honorable Minister Farrakhan said, adopt a prisoner, right? I took it a step forward. Ceasefire took it a step forward. We started Adopt a Prisoner for Life project, right? So when brothers come home, we would help them find jobs. That's when jobs was available. If not, we would show them entrepreneurial skills so it would satisfy their parole officers, such as selling bottled spring water, making T-shirts and selling T-shirts. We had crisis intervention, mentor, athletic training, boxing, job preparation, computer literacy training, arts and crafts, internal support, field trips, after school, homework, tutoring, and immerse our kids, life management skills, rap sessions, and entrepreneurial training. And I said silkscreen. And, you know, we taught what was taught to me by the nation.
Wow.
To do for self and kind. You feel me?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of brothers would complain, man, I can't get a job. So I went down there and talked to the parole board. And I explained to them what I was doing. And Myron Burr had my back. That we
mm-hmm.
were taking and selling water. And that we wanted to use that as a job for one that was on parole. You know? And they went in
mm-hmm.
to conference. And they came back and, you know, they said it could be done like it did.
Wow.
And
we've
done that. And a lot
and y'all
of
haven't looked back.
Back. You know? Well,
yes.
Such
a blessing.
We had a lot of setbacks, right? But the setbacks
mm-hmm.
was a setup to keep moving.
A setup. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So over 20 years ago, Ceasefire, Don't Smoke the Brothers and Sisters marched through the streets of D.C. demanding an end to black-on-black killings and calling a truce amongst five different gangs. How effective was it then, and do you think it could be as effective today?
No. And the reason why is behind the fact that once again, Allah blessed us. You know, you didn't say that it was gang members that marched through the streets of Washington, D.C. saying, cease fire, right? A lot of gangs didn't believe it at first. But when they seen us moving like that and it was all gang members, they say, shit, man, we tired of this killing. You know, we're the only ones in this city that has cleaned up their own community up here where our community center is at. It used to be called Dodge City. It had drugs everywhere, gunfire going off every place. And the young brothers came to me that was part of Ceasefire. They say, sir, we tired of this crack. We tired of this heroin being up here. If you talk to the elders that's doing it, then we're going to go tell the youngest that's doing it. That we don't want it up here no more. And we did that. And we made this a neutralized area where every gang in the city could come and squash their beat. Every Friday and Saturday, we had 500 to 600 in our building. This is where the TCV and all of them got their start from. The different bands that's popular today. They couldn't play
mm-hmm.
no place. They're gold bands. They couldn't play no place there because they were too young. But they could play in here. So what we would do was showcase one and pay one. Showcase one and pay one. We had two little small incidents. People came here. A couple brothers came here and wanted to show off. But we quickly stopped that. You feel me? And you know, that's why we got to respect all across the city of the different gangs and youths that was under us. Now we got a different type of brothers and sisters that's out there. They got no cut card. They got more hate in them. They feel more worthless. And this is behind the fact that nobody's trying to wing them the way
mm-hmm.
that I want these brothers to wing them. See, they victims
mm-hmm.
too. The ones that pull the triggers, man, they victims as well. You feel me? They're our people. And we have a tendency to look at what white folks has done. See, that's where the drive-by shootings come from. Don't nobody want to say that. Right, you don't hear no white on white, but you hear the term black on black crime, right? Well, white folks get up on 154 miles an hour. But when they and do drive-bys, they make movies. And that becomes folk hero. When it happens in our community, they make a movie and they call it The Predator, like President Clinton passed the Predator Bill, right? They make the movie, and the beast, the Predator, got dreadlocks. You know, saying that we don't make no dope, we don't make no crack, we don't make no weapons, we don't make no bullets.
Don't make no guns.
How the hell is it all in our neighborhood?
Right, only in our neighborhood. Cause I want to remind callers to press no. Join the conversation and to speak with Brother Al Malik. Yeah, I agree 100%. I agree 100%. And we do best stuff is being put into our communities, and we know that. Speaking of which, brother, deliberately, yes, it's definitely intentional. So, speaking of the gun violence, brother, and our innocent babies are being killed at an alarming rate. What do you attribute this recklessness to?
You're
talking about. Their lack of love?
That has that too, right? I think that you asked me a question offline, and I was explaining to you that they got sisters out here that's firing them guns, that's doing drive-bys and things of that nature. When back in the day, sisters wasn't involved in this. You feel me? They got babies that's being recruited at 10 and 9 years old. You feel me? And they're finding that gap. Different cities across the country, you'll find that part of their initiation is to go and pop something. You know, take someone's life at that early age, man, and being recruited. Uh-huh. But in our day, we wouldn't take and put no drugs in a baby's hand. We wouldn't.
Right.
We wouldn't. Right. We wouldn't put no.
That goes back to the code you were talking about earlier about the code that you guys had. And they don't have it today. I wonder where it is coming from in terms of female sisters and that surprised me because I had no idea that sisters were actually gang banking to that degree, especially in the DMV.
Are you kidding? You got sisters out there acting harder than brothers. All right. So that's a real reality. It's nothing imaginary. You feel me? I mean, they're really just calling shots. You know, tell it, man. You go,
wow.
You know, yes, that's a reality, man. Until we wake up now, I'm not saying, and please understand everybody's listening, I'm not saying that's why these sisters is being shot, right? You understand? Whether they had something to do with something or not, right? But I'll say 86% of the murders that take place, women are involved in it, directly or indirectly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wow. That's a newsflash to me. I mean, I knew in terms of the domestic aspect of it, but I never knew any other way that they could have been involved as far as like calling the cops and stuff like that. This is for me to know that. Go ahead.
Hello?
I'm sorry, go ahead, brother.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now.
Yes.
You say You say somebody was on the. No, you say somebody else was on the line.
No, I was saying that. I think we got disconnected. We had a caller, but I think we got disconnected. What's ceasefire? Those Smoky Brothers has been successful from the beginning. You said that there may have been there were some setbacks here and there, but for the most part, they're very successful in the community. And what do you think sets ceasefire aside from the others, apart from the other organizations?
Well, I don't compare us against no other organization because we're not in competition. You feel me?
Right.
Other organizations might compare themselves against us, right? But we're not in competition.
Mm-hmm.
You feel me?
Right.
You
right.
Know, if you about this work here, right? You ain't got no time to be in competition. You feel me?
Right.
Now,
right. Maybe I worded that incorrectly because I just wanted to say to see the difference in terms of the success of ceasefire, why it's been so successful.
Well, maybe it's because you have a former gang leader at the helm of
mm-hmm.
it, which is me,
mm-hmm.
and I recruited
yeah.
the other gang members, right?
Mm-hmm.
You feel me?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
we know the gang. We know the gang mentality, the gang jargon, and et cetera. Now, watch this.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 years ago, the Attorney General, which I love, but he knows nothing about this violence, he brings a group in this town called Cure Violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that stole our name, Cease Fire, right? Back in 1993, they changed the name. Now, we got brothers that just came home that don't know the history, right? Good men that don't know the history. And they went for it, you know, thinking that it was going to generate some funds and things of that nature. When we was over in Union Temple, because that's where they had the meeting at. And Brother Yango Sawyer was listening, as well as I and others, and he said, man, and jumped up, we know that program. And when he said that, and the brother said something else, I said, damn, that's ceasefire's program, meaning our program, right?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
mm-hmm.
They brought them in town, and they were supposed to be all this and all that. So we stopped serving the whole city, right? And we just started concentrating on up here in Ward 4. Prior to that, we were serving the whole city. See, I have seen in different cities when that money was involved, I've seen the wars break out between those that's supposed to be serving the community, supposed to be stopping the killing. So I know the pitfall. So we got out the way. Now that we out the way from over there doing all that, then the murder rate has escalated. It hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
You feel me? It's nowhere it was when we started in the 90s, right? It's nowhere near like that. 500 and 600. I mean, these were bodies a year. Bodies. You know, you might have 500 shot, but not 500 bodies.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, they what they doing, baby, is experimenting. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now the dude that was over top of public safety, the mayor, deputy mayor for Merle Bowser. This guy didn't have a clue, man. You can't read this shit in no book.
Right,
make
right.
It's not in there.
Right. Absolutely. See, the thing is, when you come from the streets, you know the streets. And that's why I believe that they are so receptive to the Ceasefire Don't Smoke the Brothers and Sisters organization, because a person like you, you know the game, you know the streets, you came from the streets, and you have changed it around. And I believe that that's why they have the utmost respect for you and the brothers a part of that organization, because you're not talking about what you heard. You talk about brothers and sisters, and because you guys aren't talking about what you heard, you all are talking about what you know. It's from experience, and that by far is the best teacher. So, as we prepare to close, okay. So on Friday they're having the anniversary of the 57 March on Washington. Will Ceasefire and Don't Smoke the Brothers and Sisters be participating?
No. Well, I can't say some of the members might go because it's a very worthy cause. And as you know, we are the ones that started this attack on the assassins with badges, the Metropolitan Police Department, back in 1995, right? When they killed young Sean Evans, who was 14 years old. And he was killed by Officer Mark Green in 1995. And Officer Green, allegedly, him and other white officers in 4D dollars apiece to see who could kill the first nigger or spick. And the next day after killing Sean Evans, he was paid $5,000. And they said it was for a paint party that they paid. But we got information from other law enforcement that said what I just said was the actual truth, that they was putting up $50 a week. See, now watch this. This is someplace else where we don't want to go. A Lieutenant Law Duckett, who they forced off the force, they ran the Delta Squad, came here and spoke to the gang members. And he said, man, did you think that the drive-by that might have happened in your block was your rival, was your enemy, when in actuality it was the police that was doing the drive-by, right? Now, I witnessed this out in L.A. You feel me? Now, ask yourself, how is it that 14th and Spring Road, which is a haven for police, at least 18 to 20 of them, up until 2 weeks ago, would be on that whole little area, right? All on Spring Road 14, all on 14th Street. Motor scooters, sites, bikes, and everything else, right? How do three people drive down and jump out the car and spray 9 people and get away? Right? How does over there in Southeast on the Boyd Street, 200-some people or 500-some people, and they got about 30 or 40 police out there, right? And 20 people get shot, and one died. One police officer appearing to get away. Go down to number one precinct, go on the fifth floor, and look at, have them take you through a tour, the fifth floor, where they got cameras all over the city. Go down to the Reeves building on the eighth floor. Now, these cameras can look in alleys, corners, and everything, right? How you think when white folks get killed, they find them just that fast?
Right.
The purpose.
Let me just say this before we go.
You know, they say you can tell the people about the work they do. For the last 12 years, we have had a 6-month moratorium on stopping the killing cookout amateur boxing match. We don't have the police down there, right, on the block. We'd ask for them to stay away. White shirts can come, They get on the line, they feed the people in the whole shot. But we haven't had one incident in 12 mm-hmm. years. 5,000 people we feed. You feel me? You know, so that says nothing about what we do. And the only security we have had was the Nation of Islam. Now, that's another thing. How could the Nation of Islam go clean up Mayfair and Paradise and Clifton Terrace, right? And all of a sudden you take their contracts away from them. So what are you saying? What are you telling the people? Now, here's the people that got a method and it's workable and got a track record. And, come on, man. They don't want to
Yes.
Why do they want to?
Right, they don't. Brother Malik, it is a pleasure and an honor to have you on the show. That time went so fast. We're going to have to do two because you have so much knowledge that you are dropping, and I'm sure the listeners are receptive to it. So I just want to say thank you so much as we close out. And I want to to the audience, Brother Al Malik Farrakhan is a leader in a community that is committed to bring peace to the streets. I commend him for his vision of fire, don't smoke, the brothers and sisters, and the work that they continue to do with at-risk youth in the DMV. Next week's guest will be Larry Graham. I'm sorry?
I was getting ready to say.
Go ahead.
I was getting ready to say, I'm nobody's leader. I'm an empty vessel looking to take my people to safety.
Okay. Brother Al Malik Farrakhan is an empty vessel that's taking leading his people. I want to thank him for being on the show this evening. Next week's guest will be Larry Graham, a D.C. native, who went from ground zero selling drugs and doing 10 years in prison to becoming the CEO of the Athletic Performance Enhancement Program in Arizona. If you have a story of injustice you would like to share or would like to recommend a topic for discussion on a future show, please DM me. I am also Melinda Robertson across all social media platforms. Thanks for tuning in tonight, and we will be back at it again next Tuesday from 9 p.m. Stay safe and be blessed. Peace.
We love you, baby. Thank you.
Love you too, bro.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is
bugging. It's one or two suckers, ignorant brothers, trying to rob and steal from one another. You get caught in the mid. So to crush that stereotype, here's what we did. We got ourselves together.